Welcome to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Marge Taniwaki. Marge was born Margaret Aicho Yamada in Los Angeles in late September of 1941 to Japanese immigrant parents. 2 months later, the United States entered World War II after the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. And 7 months later, Marge and her family, along with 120,000 other Japanese Americans, were rounded up and imprisoned in hastily constructed government prison camps. Some were former racetrack stables and others were stockyards. Marge has carried the trauma of that experience throughout her life, and while many were busy trying to deny or forget that part of our history, Marge has been working tirelessly to remind them that remembering and telling the truth about terrible events is the only way to restore social order and help trauma victims heal. Marge has devoted her life to helping people understand the intergenerational trauma false imprisonment has had on Japanese Americans and their descendants. Marge started our conversation remembering her childhood in the Manzanar prison camp in Central California.
So at the age of 7 months until I was four, I was incarcerated at Manzanar concentration camp near Death Valley in California, along with my paternal grandparents, an uncle, my father and mother, an older brother and sister, and about 10,000 of the 125,000 of Japanese ancestry who were incarcerated by the United States government after Pearl Harbor, or several months after they could institute the policies that they had actually planned to a great extent. I've never believed that Pearl Harbor was a sneak attack. The U.S. had gathered information on our communities. 90% of the Japanese who lived in the United States in the 1940s lived along the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California, and it was from the coastal area that the incarcerees were taken, along with the portions of Arizona, in what was called the Western Defense Zone. And they arrested my grandfather on December 7th, on the very day that Pearl Harbor was attacked by the nation of Japan.
So they'd been doing background on a lot of people.
They had been
in the early 40s.
Absolutely.
So how old were you when you...
I was 7 months old when I went in, and I was four when I left.
Wow.
So that was the average time, about 4 years, close to 4 years, that the bulk of the 125,000 were kept in the camps. In addition, in collusion with the United States government, much of Latin America sent their Japanese to the United States, to a place in Texas called Crystal City, very near Dilley, which now, of course, hold the children who are separated by Trump,
right,
from their parents.
And there also was a camp in Colorado as well, right?
Yes, there one of the 10 major camps was in southeastern Colorado, and that's the one which a few years ago we were able to make into a part of the national park system.
4 years in prison as a family, how did that affect you and your family?
Mm-hmm.
Because you lost everything, right? Can you speak to that?
Yes, we did. My father had a produce market in Los Angeles. He had just purchased a half-ton pickup truck in order to go to the wholesalers and bring back apples, oranges, fresh vegetables. And he had to sell it for $50, and he was lucky to get that because people knew that we were being forced to leave. And so actually, if they just waited long enough, they could just take it for free. One of the things that many of the families did, including my father, was to burn everything that had any connection with Japan. My mother told me that he even burned my birth certificate, and she tried to pull it out of the coal stove, but it was too late, and it was just turned to ash.
So you lose your culture and
yes.
all your possessions.
Yes, and everything that my mother had brought back from Japan. My mother was part of a group called Kibei, the same age level as the Nisei, or the second generation. So a Kibei would be born in the U.S., having U.S. citizenship, but sent to Japan for their education. Mm. My mother, Kimiko, was sent to Japan at the age of 5 and came back when she was 19. Her own mother, who was a U.S. citizen, having been born in San Francisco, died of tuberculosis, and that was a very fearsome disease back then. And when my mother returned from Japan, she had to be married off right away, and she did
because
have an arranged marriage with my father
because of the stigma
of the tuberculosis.
Wow.
Because almost all marriages were arranged marriages back then, and so before anyone could discover that my grandmother had died from tuberculosis, she had to be married off. And there was a large age difference between my father and my mother. My father was 11 years older than my mother, so he was 30 and she was 19. So that also created many other difficulties in the family life.
What was she like, your mother?
She was very imperious, and I didn't learn why until much later on in my life. And when I learned that her great-grandfather, so my great-great-grandfather, came to the United States in 1860. So my great-great-grandfather, his name was Muragaki Awaji no Kami, or the Lord of Awaji. Awaji is a small island in the Sea of Japan, which is kind of like a fiefdom of its own. So, and this came at the end of a almost close to 300-year period of self-chosen isolation in Japan. So imagine, this was the first ship to leave Japan on pain of death, right? And so Muragaki comes here as a diplomat with a covey of other samurai. But he was actually in a class called Hatamoto. So if you compare it to England, you have the imperial family and the samurai. Everybody uh-huh. is pretty familiar with that. In between is this class called Hatamoto, which translates to like lords and ladies, if you compare it to England. This is to say that my mother lost her, amongst the many things that she lost with our incarceration, was that connection to her. She lost her inheritance, basically.
Yes.
And so...
And her sense of self.
Yes. And all of the physical proof of who she was, what family she was descended from.
Which is happening to people today.
Actually, yes. And the children who are being separated from their parents by Trump, some of them are so young that there would be no way for them to have any memory to be able to say who parents were, or, you know, the unspeakable cruelty is what I see.
It must be really hard for you
having
experienced that. You're still dealing with trauma. It doesn't go away.
It doesn't
like grief.
Go away.
And
right.
So I grieve. What you're experiencing is on a whole nother scale. Mm-hmm. To see mm-hmm. the kind of cruelty that we had always hoped would never happen again, but
exactly.
has. How did your family deal after leaving Manzanar? They'd lost everything. I read where you said that you got $25 and a bus ticket.
Bus ticket.
And you couldn't return to the coast of, right. Explain that.
Right. It was amongst the many head trips that the government applied to us. I learned not so long ago that, well, so my grandfather was arrested on December 7th, taken away by the FBI. He was kept in a separate special camp where he was interrogated every day very harshly.
That was in Missoula, right?
Missoula, Montana.
Yes.
Right. He was pressured to return to Japan. He refused for a long time. I know this because a friend of mine had been doing research at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and the U.S. keeps very good records.
When they want to, yeah.
Yes, when they want to, right.
Yeah.
Right. They are an information-gathering entity.
Organism.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so apparently whatever extreme pressure they put on him made him finally say that he would return to Japan, but only if my mother and father and our nuclear family would be able to go with him. Huh. And I have no one left today to be able to follow up to see why that it didn't happen. Hmm. And the uncle that I spoke about being with me in camp, his name was Kosaku Yamada. He voluntarily joined the U.S. military. And on one of the trips back to the United States, after Uncle Ko, he served in a unit called the Military Intelligence Service, the MIS, where he translated documents, interrogated Japanese prisoners. Mm. And then he served in MacArthur's occupation forces in Japan. And Uncle Ko never came back to the U.S. except for when he had to renew his papers. And on one of those trips back to the U.S., I was able to ask him why he volunteered to serve in the U.S. military. And he said to me, with no sense of irony, he said, well, he said it would be rotting in the camp at Manzanar or rotting in the Army. So he chose the Army.
Wow. How did your mom and dad deal after leaving Manzanar? What did you see? Mm-hmm. What were the changes you saw in them?
It was not good. I mean, I was a child, but a child can be very perceptive about...
You were probably pretty puzzled, though. What this is the world right. I've been born into.
When we came to Denver, the reason that we came to Denver was we had a family friend who had opened up a small soy sauce factory at 3500 Larimer Street in Five Points.
Right.
And it's now a very high-end Chinese restaurant called Hop Alley.
And it's a historical district for Japanese, right? Isn't that where a lot of Japanese settled in that area?
Yes. Yes, uh-huh. So my father was guaranteed a job in this soy sauce factory, and I grew up in that factory when we got here in 1945. I would go to the factory and watch him work. One of the jobs that he had was to wash bean sprouts in these tubs of ice-cold water. Mm. And he would wear these galoshes and rubber apron and long gloves. But his hands were always chapped because the water was so cold. So you wash the bean sprouts, and then he would pack them into bushel baskets and then deliver them to restaurants around the area. A few years later, in order to make a little more money, he became a gardener. And I think that that's what actually killed him. He died of cancer. And if he had been able to, if we hadn't been removed from Southern California, where my father had a produce market,
right,
he wouldn't have been working as a gardener handling malathion and all of the other right. kinds of pesticides right. And things. And I really do believe that his death was from handling all of those kinds of...
And what reason did the government give for not allowing people to go back to their homes?
They didn't want us to cluster together again. And you see that in the migrants who come today, that it's a you know, because we became, the Japanese who migrated here became a threat.
Yes.
They made land that white farmers didn't want to work, like next to the railroad tracks or underneath the power lines, because it was harder to bring the large machinery in. And yet the Japanese were industrious and they grew strawberries and had the, so it was called truck farming. So because they would truck all of the goods
right. into
the city of Los Angeles and sell their produce, and they would experiment with different vegetables or different strains of food and make them better or tastier or more nutritious.
Well, it's the immigrant story. I mean, it's
exactly.
repeated. The Hmong people who came from Vietnam during the 60s.
Exactly.
The Italians, the northern Italians yes. who came and
yes.
basically
Every
owned the Upper Valley near Aspen, Colorado back in the day.
Yes.
So, yeah, it is part of the immigrant story.
Uh-huh. And every group
really
has done that. And how is it that we learn about each other? It's very often through food and what we bring culturally to this country.
What did you, as looking back and reflecting on your life, how did that experience change your family's life? What was the intergenerational trauma that people had to deal with?
It was mostly the hierarchy, which every grouping has. For instance, everyone wants to say that their ancestors were samurai.
Right.
It's like a cool thing, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The swords and all the shuriken, you know, the where you throw the metal stars and decapitate
of
people.
Course.
And and here's my, so because the original question was about my mother, how she was always so imperious. So because she came from that Hatamoto class between
right.
the imperial family and the samurai. So she lost that inheritance. She lost the book that she had that had her mon, the family crest that is on your formal kimono. For instance, the imperial crest has designs on it that no one else can use.
Hmm.
And so she would have been, even though she was a woman, she would still have been part of that class, had whatever it is that people in that particular class in Japan were privy to.
Well, so did that make her an unhappy person for the rest of her life? Because that's quite a loss.
She
lost her status.
She never recovered from that. And all of us children really tried to help her to get past that. She never recovered a sense of self. She lashed out at us children and she never hugged us or praised us, but we knew innately that we were supposed to come home with the only A's in school. And my older sister actually won a full scholarship to Wellesley College, one of the what they call the Seven Sisters. My brother became an engineer. They both graduated first in a class from Manual High School. If you look at the old annuals from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the student body was probably at least a quarter Japanese. And that's because we all lived in the Five Points area because of redlining. So it's the only place that we could actually live for a long time.
I read that something that you said, my parents never talked about what happened.
That's right.
It wasn't until I was a teenager that we started to have difficult conversations. I think it was true not only of your family, but of other Japanese families where the elders didn't want to talk about it.
Exactly.
But the children are going, hey, what was that just happened to us?
Well, I had all of these memories of playing in the desert sand at Manzanar, which was very close to Death Valley. And my mother told me never to touch the barbed wire because people had been shot and killed for doing that. There was one of the guard towers that ring the camp was very close to our barracks. And I could look up from where I was playing in the sand and see the soldier standing in his uniform, wearing actually a World War I helmet, because the U.S. wasn't actually prepared militarily for that kind of equipment. And so the kind of helmet that people are more familiar with was, so they used the old, for the guards at Manzanar, they used the old World War I helmets. And he would be he always carried a rifle with a fixed bayonet on the end. And I don't think that any child should have those kinds of memories.
No.
The food was terrible.
So you had to line up for food.
Line up for food and hold my mother's hand, not say anything. And I used to watch the desert insects crawl up and down the tar paper that covered the barracks. There was no real insulation. It was just the tar paper that covered the outside of the very thin wood that the barracks were built from. They were built to military specifications for use between 6 to 8 months by the military. So very, very fragile kinds of things. And there was no furniture inside when we got there. The only thing that was there was either a coal-burning stove or oil-burning stove.
What kind of clothing did you have to withstand the elements?
You know, all of U.S., or mostly the rural parts, ordered their things through catalogs, the Sears Roebuck catalog.
Right.
And so there were four sewing machines in the camp at Manzanar for 10,000 people. My mother had to sign up for her turn to use the sewing machine. But prior to that, she would go through the catalog, order patterns and material, pin the pattern onto the material, and cut everything out so that it was ready to sew when her turn came to use the sewing machine. And I can remember my mother always put me in a basket by the side of the treadle because there was no electricity. There was just one light overhead for a light bulb. And so the sewing machine had to be run on a treadle with a... So I can remember the sound of the treadle as she sewed through the night. Because
you basically pumped it with your foot.
Yes.
Right?
And she could keep it for 48 hours, so she tried to sew for the entire time. Otherwise, we wouldn't have anything to wear.
Nobody slept during that time.
Sorry.
Yeah. I can imagine it was...
And the only time that I can remember that having something, clothing ordered from the catalog was when we were ready to leave the camp. My parents ordered identical maroon coats for me and my sister. They had little bows made of the same material, maroon material. So we took a bus from Manzanar to Salt Lake City, and then we got onto a train in Salt Lake City. The trains were very crowded, so it was the war hadn't quite come to an end. There was no place to lie down and sleep, and so I can remember on the after we left Salt Lake, on one of the nights we slept in a little space that was next to where the toilets were. It had a little bit of a rug and two lounge chairs, and my mother pushed the lounge chairs together, and she slept there, and my sister and I slept on the rug next to the lounge chairs, and we covered ourselves with the maroon coats. Wow. that came through the Serge Robert catalog. And I can still remember hearing the sound of the wheels going over the railroad tracks as we sped through the night on our way to Denver.
That was Marge Taniwaki, peacemaker, historian, teacher, and social healer. At 85, Marge is still speaking to those who will listen about injustice of immigrant roundups and imprisonment and the intergenerational trauma it inflicts on its victims, their families, and ultimately our society. Thanks, Marge, for loving your country even when it hasn't loved you back. You are a national treasure, and we are grateful for all you have done for us. You've been listening to the Immigrant Stories program. For more on immigrant stories, go to immigrantstories.net or to kdnk.org. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts and on Facebook. Thanks for listening.